We would like to thank the fun and challenging Best Fiends for their support. If you listen to the show for a while, you know that I'm obsessed with Best Fiends. So stop crushing the same old candy and try a puzzle game with something fresh to offer. Download Best Fiends free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. And we would also like to thank Acorn TV for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Acorn TV is the largest commercial-free British streaming service that features compelling stories, exclusive premieres, and originals you won't find anywhere else. To try Acorn TV free for 30 days, go to acorn.tv and use promo code COLD in all lowercase letters only. Thank you and enjoy the show.
October 8, 2009. Latimer County, Oklahoma. 44-year-old Bobby Jameson, his 40-year-old wife, Sherilyn Jameson, and their 6-year-old daughter, Madison Jameson, leave their home to look at land in a remote mountainous area, but never return. 8 days later, their abandoned pickup truck is discovered on a dirt road. But even though the family's dog is locked inside and a bag containing $32,000 is hidden under the driver's seat, the Jamesons are missing. In 2013, the skeletal remains of Bobby, Sherilyn, and Madison are discovered less than 3 miles from where their truck had been parked. But since the authorities are unable to determine an exact cause of death, no one knows what actually happened to them. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're covering a highly requested case involving a couple and their young daughter, the 2009 disappearances and subsequent deaths of the Jameson family. That voice you just heard narrating our opening was Jenny Kapoor, the latest winner of our Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Jenny. This is a monthly contest which we've been holding for 4 years now, and if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, the Jameson family was the case Jenny requested I cover when she originally entered the contest, and since she's far from the only listener who has made this request, I thought now would be an ideal time to cover it. In fact, I talked about this case in the Patreon-exclusive bonus episode I released in September, titled The Trail Went Hot, Part 2, as this is technically considered to be a half-solved mystery. The Jameson family may no longer be missing persons, but we still don't have any idea how they died. So in case you're not already familiar with it, this is the baffling story of Bobby and Sherilyn Jameson, a married couple who decided to travel out to a remote mountainous area with their 6-year-old daughter Madison, but they never returned, and their abandoned truck would be discovered over 1 week later. The Jamesons had apparently traveled to this location to see about purchasing a plot of land, but their dog and most of their personal items were found locked inside the truck, including a bank bag containing $32,000 in cash. The Jamesons would remain missing for the next 4 years, until their remains were discovered in the exact same area less than 3 miles away, but enough time had passed that no one could determine the exact cause of death for any of the three victims. It's possible the entire family was killed by an outside party, but since Bobby and Sherilyn had been displaying a lot of erratic behavior prior to their disappearances, it's also possible that some sort of murder-suicide took place. This is one of those missing persons cases in which the discovery of the victim's remains only raise more questions than answers, so we're going to explore all the different scenarios about what happened on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. I also just wanted to announce that our podcast will be taking a brief break since I'm going to be moving to a new place, so next Wednesday, instead of the release of a new episode, we will be dropping one of our older Patreon bonus episodes into our feed as a substitute. But we will return as scheduled with another new episode the following Wednesday, December the 1st. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the unexplained deaths of the Jameson family. Our story begins in Oklahoma in 2009. Our central figures are 44-year-old Bobby Jameson and his 40-year-old wife Sherilyn Jameson, who have been together for 7 years, and live in a lakeside house in the small town of Eufaula with their 6-year-old daughter, Madison Jameson. Sherilyn also has a 12-year-old son from a previous marriage named Colton, but her ex-husband, who lives in Oklahoma City, took full custody of Colton in July of this year. On the morning of October the 8th, the Jamesons left their residence in their 4-door pickup truck and took their puppy dog, Maisie, along with them. They were planning to travel to a rural area located in Latimer County, next to the Sansois Mountains. In fact, the family had already taken a trip to this area the previous day, as Bobby had expressed interest in selling their house and purchasing a 40-acre plot of land he had read about on the internet. However, the Jamesons never returned home this time around, but this did not immediately raise any alarm bells, since they were known for being a very private family who would sometimes disappear off the radar and not contact people they knew for long periods of time. Bobby and Sherilyn had also recently pulled Madison out of school to prepare for homeschooling, so her absence wasn't noticed and the family was never officially reported missing. However, on October the 16th, 8 days after they were last seen, hunters discovered the Jamesons' abandoned pickup truck on a remote one-way dirt road in Latimer County. The truck was parked near the top of Panola Mountain in a densely wooded area, which was a short distance south of the town of Kinta and about 30 miles away from the Jameson residence in Eufaula. Bobby, Sherilyn, and Madison were nowhere to be found, but their dog Maisie was locked inside the truck. Maisie was so malnourished that she was dying of starvation and had been eating her own feces to stay alive. Thankfully, when the Latimer County Sheriff's Office was summoned to the scene, they broke the glass and rescued Maisie, and she wound up making a full recovery before she went to live with Bobby's mother, Starlet Jameson. Even though the Jamesons were missing, and the vehicle was in perfect working order, most of the family's personal possessions, including their identification, wallets, Sherilyn's purse, cell phones, coats, maps, empty prescription pill bottles, and a GPS unit, were all left behind inside the truck. While the truck was locked, the keys themselves could not be found, and there were no signs of any struggle, blood, or broken glass. However, the most surprising discovery was a bank bag containing $32,000 in cash, which was found hidden underneath the driver's seat and had been concealed by some of Bobby's tools. There was a local resident who had crossed paths with the Jamesons on a winding dirt road on October the 7th, the day before they went missing. Since they had gotten lost, Bobby stopped to ask the resident for directions. He also asked a number of questions about what it was like to live in the area and build a home there, and the witness thought the family appeared to be in good spirits. Another local resident who lived about a quarter mile away from the spot where the pickup truck was found would report having seen the Jamesons driving in that direction on October the 8th, but he never saw them leave or recalled seeing anyone else head towards that area. Over the course of the next 8 days, other witnesses remembered having seen the pickup truck parked at that spot, but since it was near an oil well, they figured the truck probably belonged to a work crew. Curiously, a search of Bobby's phone records showed that his cell phone had made an outgoing call to its voicemail on October the 12th. Investigators also checked GPS coordinates on the phone, which led them up a hill which was close to the truck, and they noticed footprints on the ground, some of which obviously belonged to Madison since they were child-sized. The footprints and the GPS coordinates eventually led to a large rock near the top of the hill. A search of Bobby's cell phone would uncover a photograph of Madison standing in front of this rock with her mouth open and her arms crossed over each other in an odd position. Since Madison appeared to be looking away from the camera, some of the family's friends and relatives believed that she looked frightened and uncomfortable, possibly because the photo was being taken by someone else besides her parents, whom she did not know. In spite of this, police did think that the Jamesons managed to walk back down the hill and climb into their truck, and may have attempted to drive away before something happened. Even though Latimer County Sheriff Israel Beecham would launch a massive search operation in the area surrounding the truck, it failed to turn up any trace of Bobby, Sherilyn, or Madison. Since the Jamesons had security cameras installed outside their residence which pointed directly at the driveway, Sheriff Beecham watched the footage of them preparing to leave on October the 8th. It showed Bobby and Sherilyn making at least 20 trips back and forth between the house and their pickup truck in order to load it with items, and oddly, they would sometimes move the same items multiple times. The couple did not seem to speak or acknowledge each other while this was going on, and Sheriff Beecham described them as appearing to be in a quote-unquote trance-like state, as they would sometimes just stop and stare with vacant looks on their faces. One of the most curious details about the footage is that it showed Sherilyn loading a brown briefcase into the truck, which was not present when the truck was discovered and has never been accounted for. In addition, Sherilyn owned a .22 caliber pistol and may have been carrying it when she left, but it could not be found in the truck or the house. Sheriff Beecham had a psychologist examine the surveillance footage in order to analyze the Jamesons' behavior, and the psychologist seemed to believe that Bobby and Sherilyn were under the influence of drugs, possibly methamphetamine, which was very prevalent in Oklahoma during that time period. However, no traces of meth or any other drugs or drug-related paraphernalia could be found in the truck or the Jameson residence, and it's never been conclusively proven if they were involved in illegal drugs in any way. But as you recall, some empty prescription pill bottles were found in the truck, as Bobby and Sherilyn were on medication and had lost a lot of weight in the months prior to the disappearance. In 2003, Bobby was involved in a serious vehicular accident with two other motorists, which seriously injured his back and caused him to suffer from chronic pain, so he was legally classified as disabled and was unable to work. Bobby filed a lawsuit against the defendants who were responsible for his accident, and according to his mother, Starlet, the suit was settled out of court for $64,000, and Bobby proceeded to split the money with his wife. Sherilyn was also legally classified as disabled and unable to work due to chronic pain in her neck and shoulder, and she also suffered from bipolar disorder and depression. Even though Sherilyn had been prescribed medication to control her condition, she did not always take it when she was supposed to. Sherilyn's depression hit her particularly hard when she lost her younger sister Marla in 2007 as a result of a bee stinging in her tongue, which caused her throat to swell. As mentioned earlier, Sherilyn also lost custody of her son Colton to her ex-husband after a hearing in which Colton stated that he would prefer to live with his father because his mother was often depressed and acted strangely. Only 1 month before she vanished, Sherilyn was hospitalized after a failed suicide attempt, and while she spoke to Colton weeks earlier, he claimed that his mother never mentioned anything to him about the family's plans to move away and purchase land in Latimer County. Bobby also had his own familial problems, as 5 months before he went missing, he filed a lawsuit against his estranged father, Bob Dean Jamison Sr., alleging that Bob had once enticed him to work for free at a gas station he owned in Oklahoma City. According to Bobby, his father had promised he would inherit a half interest in the business in exchange for his labor, but instead, Bob sold the gas station without giving any of the proceeds to his son. Bobby's relationship with his father had deteriorated so much that following the lawsuit, he also filed a petition for a protective order against him, claiming that Bob had threatened to kill his family and tried to run him over with a car. Bobby described his father as a quote-unquote very dangerous man who thinks he is above the law, and accused him of also using meth and being involved with gangs, prostitution, and the Mexican Mafia. Bob's wife Starlet had also ended their marriage of over 40 years by divorcing him, and she was the one who suggested that Bobby install security cameras outside his home in order to protect himself from Bob. In December of 2009, only 2 months after his son went missing, Bob passed away at the age of 67. It would turn out that 1 year earlier, Bob had made his brother, Jack Jamison, executor of his estate and cut Bobby and Starlet out of his will. Instead, Bob left his entire estate to his granddaughter, though of course by the time he died, Madison was no longer around to inherit it. In spite of the heated relationship between Bobby and his father, investigators ultimately concluded that Bob had a solid alibi during the time period his son went missing and was likely not involved in the family's disappearance. While Jack Jameson did acknowledge that his brother was a disturbed man, Jack also said that Bob spent the majority of his final few months in either a hospital or a rest home, and Jack did not believe he was physically capable of traveling to a rugged mountainous area to commit murder. Another person who was looked at as a potential suspect was a family friend named Kenneth Bellows, who had spent a couple of months living at the Jameson residence as a boarder in exchange for helping out and doing handiwork around the house. However, in July of 2009, Bellows revealed himself to be a white supremacist, and since Sherilyn had Native American heritage, he told her that anyone who did not have pure white blood deserved to die. This led to a heated argument, in which Sherilyn grabbed a gun and pointed it at Bellows' head and demanded he get out of their house, and she also fired a shot into the ground beneath Bellows' feet to convince him to leave. Even though Bellows had an extensive criminal record, investigators cleared him of having any involvement in the Jamesons' disappearance, since it turned out he was in jail during that time period. But interestingly enough, Sherilyn's closest friend, Nikki Shenold, claimed that she once got an anonymous phone call from a woman who said she belonged to a white supremacy group. The woman claimed that she saw the Jamesons' names in a book which contained a list of people whom the leader of this group supposedly had a problem with, and she also said she overheard conversations about how the family had been taken care of. While the caller was never identified, one reason Nikki believed she might have been telling the truth was because she accurately described the insignia on Bobby's wedding ring, a piece of information that very few people knew. No one ever emerged as a solid suspect in the Jamesons' disappearance, and Bobby and Sherilyn had both displayed troubling and erratic behavior before they went missing. At separate times, the couple told their local pastor that they believed their home was haunted, as they had supposedly seen spirits inside the residence and on the roof. In fact, Bobby asked the pastor for advice on how to get rid of them, and asked if there was a quote-unquote special bullet he could buy which was made to kill spirits. Sherilyn also said that Madison had been speaking with the spirit of a deceased child named Emily, but Sherilyn feared it was a malevolent entity. She seemed to believe that she had the power to exorcise these demons from the home, and had been consulting satanic Bibles for information about how to deal with the problem. The Jamesons also had a large storage container on their property that they were apparently planning to live in if they purchased a plot of land in Latimer County. At one point, Sherilyn wrote some graffiti on the container, which read, quote, "Three cats killed to date by people in this area, witches don't like their black cats being killed," end quote. The story goes that Sherilyn's cat had passed away, and she believed that her neighbors had poisoned it, and since there were reportedly rumors circulating throughout the community that Sherilyn was a witch, she decided to write this message in order to scare everyone off. A number of letters were found inside the Jamieson residence, which seemed to indicate that Bobby and Sherilyn were obsessed with death, but one of the most troubling pieces of evidence was an angry 11-page letter Sherilyn had written to Bobby, which was found inside their pickup truck. The whole thing was described as a quote-unquote hate letter, in which Sherilyn expressed her desire for a divorce, referring to her husband as a loner and a hermit, and accusing him of not caring about their daughter. One particularly troubling line she wrote read, quote, "I would not wish my daughter to be raised in foster care because of you being in prison for attempted murder and her mother dead," end quote. Some of Sherilyn's friends confirmed that she had spoken of divorcing Bobby and that the writing in her letter represented the type of mood swing Sherilyn experienced whenever her bipolar disorder took over. The family would remain missing for over 4 years and receive national exposure when the case was featured on an episode of Disappeared, which aired in December of 2010. However, on November the 16th, 2013, a family was on a deer hunting trip in Smokestack Hollow, a valley located just northwest of the Sansbois Mountains in Latimer County, when they discovered three human skulls which appeared to belong to two adults and a child. A further search of the area would soon turn up additional skeletal remains, as well as bits of clothing and shoes. Since this location was less than 3 miles away from the spot where the Jamesons' pickup truck had been abandoned, it was immediately assumed the remains belonged to the family, but it would not be until July of 2014 when it was officially announced that the victims have been positively identified as Bobby, Sherilyn, and Madison. Unfortunately, since heavy decomposition and animal predation had taken place, the medical examiner cannot determine an exact cause of death for any of them. Due to Bobby and Sherilyn's erratic behavior prior to their disappearances, one possible theory which was pushed forward is that either or both of them could have orchestrated a murder-suicide which involved killing their daughter before they killed themselves, but no murder weapon could be found at the scene. Since the weather had been cold on the day the family disappeared, and they left their coats behind in the truck, there was also speculation that they could have wandered off and gotten lost before they died of exposure, but this could not be conclusively proven either. The victims' relatives and friends still seem to believe they were murdered, with one of the wildest theories being presented by Sherilyn's mother, Connie Cocatan, who believed that a religious cult operating in southwest Oklahoma had put the family on their hit list. While Connie did not name this cult, she refused to believe that Bobby or Jameson would have done anything to harm Madison, and once mentioned a discussion that Bobby had had with Sherilyn about the family's financial troubles, where he stated, quote, "I know where I can get the money, but I won't involve you," end quote. Unfortunately, since the Jamesons' remains were discovered 8 years ago, there don't appear to have been any major developments in the investigation, so the exact circumstances of how they died continues to remain a bizarre, unsolved mystery. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, I would like to take a moment to give a shout-out to one of my favorites, Best Fiends. If you've listened to this podcast for the past 2 years, you'll know that I'm obsessed with playing Best Fiends year-round, but I especially love playing it during the holiday season. It's the perfect pick-me-up when I need a break from the holiday action. Best Fiends has it all: an amazing storyline, collectible fiends, and tons of fun puzzles. I'm not joking when I say there are times I can't put it down. It is quite possibly the best puzzle game out there. And if you happen to find yourself in a situation where there's no Wi-Fi, that's no problem, because you can play Best Fiends wherever and whenever you want with offline mode. So even if your holiday travels take you off the beaten path, you can still play Best Fiends. And not to brag, but in my last Best Fiends ad, I discussed my goal of making it to level 2050, but I'm happy to say that I managed to surpass my goal over the past few weeks and have made it all the way to level 2150. Best Fiends has literally thousands of levels with more added all the time, so there's always a fresh challenge waiting whenever you need a mental pick-me-up. So download Best Fiends free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. And we would also like to take a few moments to thank Acorn TV. Can you believe the holidays are right around the corner? That's just one reason why this is my favorite time of the year. And the other reason is that with all this cold weather here in Canada, it's a good opportunity to stay inside and watch some amazing TV, and so many shows I love are on Acorn TV. Acorn TV is the largest commercial-free British streaming service that features compelling stories, exclusive premieres, and originals you won't find anywhere else. Since Acorn TV has new releases every week, you'll never have to worry about running out of content, and you'll have thousands of hours worth for a fraction of the cost compared to most streaming services at just $5.99 a month. Acorn TV is very easy to stream on your favorite device, and since they became our sponsor last month, I have already started going through their catalog and discovering a lot of new shows I had never seen before. Last month, I plugged a dramatic TV series called Manhunt, which was based on a real-life case involving a notorious serial rapist, but now I'd like to recommend an exciting new crime series titled Dog Leash, which is adapted from author P.D. James's global bestsellers, The Inspector Dog Leash Mysteries, and stars Bertie Carvel of Dr. Foster fame as Inspector Adam Dogleash. These three two-part films are set in mid-1970s England and follow the enigmatic detective as he solves unusual murders and reveals buried secrets amid some of England's most spectacular settings. Dogleash is just one of the many excellent pieces of content you'll find on this streaming service. So try Acorn TV free for 30 days by going to acorn.tv and use promo code COLD in all lowercase letters. That's acorn.tv with promo code COLD in all lowercase letters only to get your first 30 days for free. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, this case is something of a milestone for yours truly, because it happened to be the subject of the very first Disappeared episode I ever watched. And since I believed this was a very baffling mystery, I immediately became hooked on the show and was convinced it was the second coming of Unsolved Mysteries. Now, another case involving a missing family which was also featured on Disappeared and took place only 4 months after this one was the disappearance of a couple named Joseph and Summer McStay and their two young boys, 4-year-old Gianni and 3-year-old Joseph Jr., who all vanished from their home in Fallbrook, California on February the 4th, 2010. At the time, I found both these cases to be absolutely perplexing, because how often does an entire family just disappear off the face of the earth? But in a truly astonishing coincidence, even though these two cases were not connected at all and took place in different states, the McStays and the Jamesons would be discovered within the exact same week. On November the 11th, 2013, the skeletal remains of Joseph, Summer, Gianni, and Joseph Jr. were all found buried in a pair of shallow graves in a remote desert area of San Bernardino County, and of course, it would only be 5 days later when the Jamesons' remains were found. The key difference between the two cases is that the McStays were clearly the victims of foul play, and a suspect named Charles Chase Merritt would eventually be charged, tried, and convicted of their murders. But we still don't have the faintest idea of what actually happened to the Jamesons, as the cause of death for Bobby, Sherilyn, and Madison has never been determined. If foul play did take place here, it's still up for debate whether their deaths were caused by an unknown third party or a murder-suicide from someone within the family. In most cases, the latter scenario might not seem likely, but since Bobby and Sherilyn have been acting so strangely just prior to their disappearances, you just cannot rule anything out. While he isn't heading the investigation anymore, former Latimer County Sheriff Israel Beecham stated during the Disappeared episode, quote, "Most investigators would love to have the amount of evidence that we have. The problem is that it leads in every which direction," end quote. Indeed, Beecham stated that he could not eliminate any of the potential scenarios in this case, yet he acknowledged that there was no strong evidence that specifically pointed to any one of them. Of course, at the time Sheriff Beecham said this, the Jamesons were still missing persons, so I guess we can now technically eliminate a couple of potential scenarios which were put forward, such as the family going into witness protection or disappearing voluntarily to live off the grid somewhere. The fact that the Jamesons' remains were found less than 3 miles from the remote dirt road where their truck was parked shows that their deaths definitely occurred sometime after they arrived in the area. Now, even though an extensive search effort was performed of the area and failed to turn up anything, I've reiterated so many times on this podcast that even the best search operations will fail to turn up human remains, especially when you're dealing with a rugged wilderness area. There are so many missing persons cases like this, where the victim's remains or partial remains are discovered in the same area they disappeared from years after the fact, meaning that the original search effort missed them. I do think that's likely what happened in the Jamison case, though some interesting comments were provided by Tim Graham, the deer hunter who found their skulls. Even though the skulls had sunk into the soil a little bit, Graham said they were clearly visible and lying next to an easily accessible trail, so he openly expressed his surprise that the searchers never found them back in 2009. However, there was a lot of miserable weather and heavy rains during that time period, some of which took place before the truck was even discovered, and the original search team believed that the remains might have been obscured by falling leaves. Indeed, it does seem far-fetched that someone would abduct all 3 family members and murder them at another location, and then return back to the area to dispose of their bodies. But another interesting detail that Graham noticed was a hole in the top of Bobby's skull, which he believed may have been a bullet wound. While investigators said the hole might have been caused by a coyote who gnawed on the skull's edges, Graham replied, quote, "Ain't no coyote did that." Well, since no gun could be found at the scene, and there were no traces of any bullets or slugs either, it's never been conclusively proven that any of the victims were shot. One of the reasons the murder-suicide theory has gotten some traction is because a .22 caliber gun Sherilyn owned was never accounted for, but we also can't be 100% certain she even had it on her when she traveled to Latimer County. I don't know how common it is for animals to pick up guns off the ground and carry them away, but I guess that can provide a potential explanation for how a gun could have disappeared from the scene if it was used. The area was also apparently prone to flash floods, so I've seen that as a potential explanation for why the gun wasn't there. But given that the three victims' remains were all found together at the same spot, I'm not sure how much flooding would have taken place there. Now, in any unsolved case involving a deceased family, no one wants to flat-out accuse parents of killing their own child before killing themselves, unless there's definitive proof of that, but we also cannot ignore the fact that there were a number of major warning signs with Bobby and Sherilyn. Both of them were on disability and could not work, as Bobby suffered from severe chronic back pain, while Cheryl struggled with chronic pain issues of her own, as well as bipolar disorder and depression, and she had made a failed suicide attempt only 1 month before she went missing. The couple seemed to believe their house was haunted by spirits, and Sherilyn wrote cryptic graffiti on a storage container outside the residence in order to give off the impression that she was a witch and scare her neighbors. But according to those who knew her, Sherilyn may have just been playing things up because she did not like her neighbors and figured that the best way to ensure they left her alone was to make them think she was crazy. Of course, the biggest red flag was definitely the angry 11-page letter which was found inside the Jamesons' pickup truck, where Sherilyn expressed a lot of anger towards Bobby and seemed intent on ending the marriage. Given how they seemed to believe that Madison was communicating with malevolent spirits, it's possible that either or both of them could have suffered a complete mental breakdown and convinced themselves that ending Madison's life was the right thing to do before they killed themselves. While there are a lot of things about the Jamesons' actions which don't make any sense, all rules pretty much go out the window when you're dealing with victims who are suffering from potentially serious mental health issues and could also be under the influence of drugs. While no gun was found at the scene, there were a lot of empty pill bottles inside the truck, so if a suicide took place, it could have been the result of some sort of overdose which would have been impossible to determine after they'd been skeletal remains for 4 years. Now, on the disappeared episode, the family's friends and relatives acknowledged that even though Bobby and Sherilyn had gone through a rough patch, their decision to relocate and buy a plot of land in the mountains was their attempt to make a fresh start. While Sherilyn's letter gave off the impression that she felt a lot of hatred towards Bobby, we technically don't know when exactly it was written. For all we know, it could have been written weeks earlier and left inside the truck, but things had actually improved for them since then. However, there has been speculation that this trip to look at land was just a cover story for something more nefarious, such as drug dealing. While no direct evidence has ever been found to prove that Bobby and Sherilyn were dealing or using drugs, I'm not surprised that some people have attempted to link their odd behavior to a methamphetamine addiction, since Oklahoma has always been known for having a major meth problem. The discovery of the $32,000 under the truck's driver's seat has also fueled speculation about drug dealing, since that seems like a lot of cash for two unemployed parents on disability to be carrying around. But before we start digging into all these theories, let's look at the circumstances of how the Jamesons wound up in that remote mountainous area of Latimer County to begin with. We do know that they already drove to this spot the day before they went missing, as a local resident confirmed having interacted with them, and since Bobby asked a number of questions about what it was like to live in the area, this does give off the impression that he was serious about buying land there. Interestingly enough, if you search online, you'll find a blog titled Keep the Search Alive, containing an old post from January of 2012, written by an online sleuth who decided to interview some people connected to this case during the time period the Jamesons were still missing. This person claimed they spoke to the resident who encountered the Jamesons and learned that she showed various properties on Panola Mountain for a real estate company. Apparently, the woman offered to show Bobby the property he was interested in buying, but he declined her offer and asked for the GPS coordinates to the spot instead. I mean, it's possible that Bobby simply wanted to look at the property on his own, but you could also infer that he did not want the real estate lady there because he had something else planned. But the biggest issue I have with the theory about the Jamesons traveling there to participate in a drug deal or some sort of illegal transaction is why would they bring their 6-year-old daughter along with them? If Bobby was involved in something potentially dangerous, why not have Sherilyn stay at home with Madison or leave the child in the care of someone else? If they wanted to scout a location that they were planning to make their new home, then yes, it makes a lot more sense to bring Madison there. And then there's the fact that the Jamesons brought the family puppy Maisie to the location and left her locked inside the truck, which nearly led to her starving to death. I mean, perhaps we shouldn't be attempting to apply standard logic to the Jamesons' actions, but if Bobby and Sherilyn were always planning on some sort of murder-suicide, it just seems exceptionally cruel to lock their dog up to slowly die over the course of several days rather than simply shooting it. By all accounts, Madison was completely attached to Maisie and considered the dog to be her best friend, so she likely would have had a meltdown if you attempted to separate them against their will. This is why it's tempting to believe that an outside party forced the Jamesons to walk to the location they were found while keeping the dog locked inside the truck. This would be the first case I've seen in which someone who had no qualms about murdering multiple people, including a child, drew the line at harming an animal. Now, one odd detail which doesn't seem to make any sense is that Bobby's cell phone was used to call its voicemail on November the 12th, 4 days after the family first arrived at that spot, and what are the chances that he would have been alive there after all that time? But since the cell phone was locked inside the truck with Maisie, the most logical explanation might be that she accidentally stepped on a button which caused the phone to call voicemail, so this detail might not have any relevance to this case. Judging from the footprints at the scene and the GPS coordinates on Bobby's cell phone, investigators believe that the entire family walked up a nearby hill towards a large rock, which is where the final photograph of Madison was taken with the cell phone. You can look up that photo online and judge for yourself, but it has always been the subject of divisive reactions and interpretations. Some people, including the Jamesons' relatives and friends, believe that Madison looks frightened and uncomfortable, possibly because the photo was being taken by someone else besides her parents. But if you search through online discussions about this case, you'll find a number of commenters who believe there's nothing out of the ordinary about it. Well, obviously, the fact that this would turn out to be the last photograph of Madison before something happened to her is incredibly eerie, but I personally have never gotten the sense that it was taken while something bad was happening, and I just don't get the impression that there's genuine fear on the girl's face. Yes, the manner in which her arms are crossed is a bit odd, but it also comes across as a typical reaction from a 6-year-old who is not in the mood to have their picture taken. I'm sure anyone with children has had moments where they just happen to snap a photo of a kid at the exact wrong second, and the end result looks incredibly awkward. I'm sure there are many family photos out there of children giving off the exact same type of reaction as Madison, but because those kids didn't wind up going missing, there's nothing ominous about them. I wouldn't rule out the possibility that Madison could have been uncomfortable because her parents were doing something she did not like, but I don't buy the theory that this photo was taken by a stranger. Remember, Bobby's cell phone was found inside the truck, so I'm not sure why an outside party would go to the trouble of using the phone to snap this picture before walking back down the hill and locking it in the truck. The theory presented by Sheriff Beecham was that after the photo was taken, the Jamesons walked down the hill on their own and climbed into the truck to drive away until someone else unexpectedly showed up. But investigators have never given off any indication that they found tire tracks from an outside vehicle at the scene, and while 8 days passed before the sheriff's office arrived, they were able to find the Jamesons' footprints, so you'd think that additional tire tracks would have been preserved as well. There was a local resident who said they saw the Jamesons driving towards that area on October the 8th, but never saw them leave, and they also did not see anyone else enter or leave the area as well. Of course, I'm sure the witness didn't have their eyes on the road the entire time, so it's possible someone else could have driven up there without being noticed, but it's such a remote spot that it makes you wonder how an outside party would have even known the family was there. I suppose the Jamesons could have made arrangements to meet someone or were followed to that spot, as they had already gone there the previous day. The scenario about them being confronted by an outside party while they were attempting to leave did make sense back in 2009 since they were still missing, because for all anyone knew, the family could have been abducted. However, the family's remains were ultimately found just under 3 miles away, and if no one else was involved, you have to wonder how they got from point A to point B. For starters, Bobby's back and chronic pain issues made it very difficult for him to walk long distances, especially on rugged terrain, so it doesn't make much sense that he would go there on his own accord. Even if he was planning a murder-suicide, why create a bunch of additional pain for yourself by walking nearly 3 miles? Another theory which has been presented is that the family wandered off and got lost before they succumbed to exposure, But why would they lock all their personal items in the truck? It was reportedly a very chilly day, so there's no reason to leave their jackets there. We know they used the GPS coordinates on Bobby's cell phone to walk up a hill towards that rock, so it makes no sense for them to come back down, put the phone in the truck, and then walk in another direction without it. But like I said earlier, we're talking about people with potentially serious mental health issues who could have been planning a murder-suicide, so trying to find logic in their actions might be pointless. Of course, the big puzzler in this case is the $32,000 hidden under the driver's seat in the truck. If the family was murdered by someone, then I can understand them not taking this money, as it was so well concealed that the killer might not have even known it was there. But this only raises the question, why did the Jamesons bring it to this location in the first place? In fact, since Bobby and Sherilyn were both unemployed and living on disability checks, where did all that cash come from? It sounds like Bobby did receive a settlement from the accident which injured him, and his mother said the amount was $64,000, which he split with Sherilyn. And given that $32,000 is half that amount, the numbers do add up, and there's also the fact that the security footage showed Sherilyn loading a brown briefcase into the truck before the family left the residence. Since this briefcase has never been accounted for, could it have contained Sherilyn's split of the settlement money? If foul play took place and there was a lot of cash in the briefcase, then the perpetrator might have stolen it without even being aware that there was additional money under the driver's seat. If that $32,000 was settlement money, then I can see why Bobby might have elected to keep the entire amount in cash rather than deposit it in the bank. The United States is known for being very rigid when it comes to checking the finances of people who are on disability to ensure that they're not making too much money and scamming the government, so perhaps Bobby did not want to leave a paper trail. But if that's the case, why did Bobby bring all that cash to Latimer County with him? I know that Bobby learned about this plot of land from the internet, but I don't have any information about who was actually selling it and if Bobby could have just approached them with $32,000 in cash in order to purchase the land. This is why there has been so much speculation that the money was going to be used for something illegal, such as buying drugs, though no evidence has ever been found to support this fact. If the family was planning to orchestrate some sort of murder-suicide, it makes you wonder why they would bother bringing all that cash with them. But then again, it's possible that only one of the parents was planning something like that, and the other was taken by complete surprise. In the end, the money was turned over to their closest surviving heir, which was Bobby's mother, Starlet, so if he was feeling suicidal, perhaps Bobby wanted to ensure that the money would be found and she would receive it. In addition to the photograph of Madison, the other odd detail which has been the subject of a lot of debate is the security footage of Bobby and Sherilyn loading their truck with items on the morning they went missing, as they reportedly walked back and forth around 20 times while never acknowledging or speaking to each other, and they were described as being in a quote-unquote trance-like state. I've seen a lot of online commenters say that they don't believe there's anything unusual about this video at all, but the problem is that the general public has only seen very brief snippets. If you search for the video on YouTube, you'll only find very brief clips that show several seconds worth of still frames, and the quality is so poor that it's impossible to clearly see Bobby and Sherilyn's faces or determine if they are in a trance-like state. However, it was Sheriff Beecham who used the phrase trance-like on the Disappeared episode, and he has seen the entire footage, so maybe he has a different interpretation, and I know that one psychologist believed that Bobby and Sherilyn's behavior matched the symptoms of people who were on drugs. But given that the marriage was not in a great place, and the couple had apparently been considering divorce, not speaking to each other while loading a truck might not be that unusual. However, Sherilyn's friend, Nikki Chenold, once mentioned during an interview that she noticed what she believed was an additional person in the video. In the footage which is available publicly, you can see separate sections which show a man wearing a white shirt and a brown shirt, and even though you can't see his face clearly, the assumption seems to be that Bobby simply changed from a white shirt into a brown shirt when he walked back into the house. But according to Nikki, there are a few frames where you can briefly see a reflection in the truck's window which simultaneously shows two different men in a white shirt and a brown shirt. I mean, I haven't personally seen this part of the footage, so I can't say for certain, but I know that law enforcement studied it extensively, and I've never heard them bring up the possibility of another man being with Bobby and Sherilyn when they left the house that day. You could assume this other person traveled with the family to Latimer County and did something to them, but the problem is that the truck was left there. So unless this person met up with someone else who gave them a ride, how did they manage to get out of the area? Like the photo of Madison, I'm not sure the security footage has any real relevance to the case, and people might just be reading too much into it because the family later went missing. I know they believe their house was haunted by spirits, but just because they were described as being in a trance-like state does not mean they were possessed by demons or that there was anything supernatural at work here. But theoretically, if the entire family were victims of foul play from an outside party, who could have been responsible? Well, the initial stages of the investigation had a couple of potentially interesting suspects who have all but been eliminated. There's Bobby's father, Bob Dean Jameson Sr., who sounds like a real piece of work. It sounds very unlikely that he was personally involved in what happened, since he was not in the best of health at that time and died only 2 months after the family went missing, but I would definitely be curious to know more about this guy's backstory. According to his obituary, Bobby was Bob's only child, but we have allegations that Bob cheated his own son out of money, tried to hit him with a car, and threatened to kill the entire family, and I think it says a lot that his wife Starlet decided to divorce him after 4 decades of marriage and was the one who suggested that Bobby put up the security cameras to protect himself. I have no idea if Bob and Bobby always had a fractured relationship, or if it just wound up going bad near the end, but even though Bob cut his son out of his will, he still seemed to care enough about his granddaughter to leave everything to her, though no one expected Madison to be a missing person by the time Bob passed away. It is interesting that Bobby had been involved in no less than 3 lawsuits before he disappeared. His lawsuit for the injuries he sustained in the accident sounds pretty reasonable, and of course Bobby's suit against his father never got the chance to be resolved. But I would sure love to know more details about why he filed a lawsuit against the school district after Madison was pulled out of school. After investigating their backgrounds, Sheriff Beecham once made a comment in which he referred to Bobby and Sherilyn as quote-unquote scammers. I'm not sure what he meant by that, but since they can no longer work, perhaps they had started a racket where they would file frivolous lawsuits as their means of generating income. If so, then I guess it's possible that their actions could have angered the wrong people and led to them being murdered, but there's no evidence to support this. We also have Kenneth Bellows, the white supremacist boarder whom Sherilyn kicked out of the house a few months before she went missing, but it sounds like Bellows was in jail during the time period the family went missing, which is about as strong an alibi as you can get. I guess the only reason you can't completely dismiss Bellows' involvement is because of that weird anonymous phone call that Nikki Shenhold received from a woman who claimed that the family was murdered by a white supremacy group. I guess it's possible this group could have decided to kill the Jamesons as revenge for Bellows being kicked out of their house, but that's a pretty weak motive, and unless they were following the Jamesons, how would the group know they would be at that particular remote area at that particular time? We also have the allegations from Sherilyn's mother that the family was put on a hit list from some sort of religious cult, but she's never provided any specific details about this, and I have no idea why she believes it. There are technically no strong suspects or persons of interest in this case, but once again, we really have no idea if there was anyone else involved to begin with. It's interesting to compare this case to the aforementioned McStay family disappearance. At the outset, there was some evidence to suggest that the McStays could have run away and disappeared voluntarily, but unlike the Jamesons, the family did not have a history of erratic behavior, and there was nothing particularly unusual going on in their lives at the time they went missing. However, because the circumstances of the disappearance were so baffling, there was one radio host who published a book about the case, which painted a less than flattering portrayal of the mother, Summer McStay, and suggested that she may have murdered her husband and fled the country with her 2 boys. Well, of course, once the entire family's remains were found in a shallow grave, and it was clear that they were all murdered by a third party, the book was pulled from circulation, and the author apologized, and even went so far as to offer a refund to everyone who purchased it. So obviously, I would be very hesitant of accusing Bobby or Sherilyn Jameson of killing their child or each other without definitive evidence. You can understand why the family's loved ones would be pushing forward theories about religious cults and white supremacy groups and whatnot, because I'm sure they would prefer not to believe that Bobby or Sherilyn or both of them were capable of orchestrating a murder-suicide. Not to mention if this is exactly what happened, there's technically no way to prove it, and it means this mystery will remain unsolved forever without a resolution. If the family was murdered by a third party, then at least there's still a killer out there somewhere who can be brought to justice, and we could potentially learn the full truth about what happened. That's exactly what happened in the McStay case when the perpetrator was arrested and convicted, but that sort of thing might just not be possible here. During online discussions of this case, I have seen the phrase folie à deux thrown around, which is the French translation for folie of two, and also known as shared psychosis and shared delusional disorder, which is what happens when symptoms of a delusional belief are transmitted from one individual to another. If the Jamesons were suffering from this, this might explain why Bobby and Sherilyn both expressed their belief that their home was haunted by spirits. They also claim that Madison had been speaking to a ghost of a girl named Emily, but even if that's true, it could have been something as harmless as a 6-year-old girl speaking with an imaginary friend and her parents thinking it was something a lot more supernatural than it really was. I know the Jamesons' friends and relatives believed that they were making a move to a remote area of Latimer County in order to repair their marriage and get a fresh start, but honestly, it would not surprise me at all if this entire decision was driven by the fact that they believed their home was haunted and they needed to get out of there. However, even though there are a number of holes in the murdered by a third party theory, there are still a number of things about the murder-suicide theory which don't make sense. If this is what happened, how would these events have played out? After walking up a hill and taking a photo of Madison next to a rock, what would compel Bobby and Sherilyn to walk back to their truck and lock their dog, cell phone, and personal items inside? Why would they then decide to take Madison and walk 3 miles to a remote spot before they killed her and took their own lives? If they used a gun, what happened to it? And what became of the brown briefcase Sherilyn loaded into the truck? I could see animals making a small gun disappear, but could they really do the same to an entire briefcase? None of the theories in this case make 100% complete sense, but at the same time, you can't eliminate all of them either. Myself, I think you can count me as being completely on the fence with this one, as there are just too many discrepancies in both the murder or suicide scenarios to lean conclusively in either direction. Regardless of which side you lean, the biggest tragedy in this story is the fact that an innocent 6-year-old girl lost her life. Even though there's no indication that Madison was ever abused or mistreated, living in a household while her parents were going through all these difficult ordeals could not have been easy for her. This is why everyone wonders what exactly was going through Madison's mind during that cryptic final photograph of her. It would be horrible enough if she was murdered by an unknown perpetrator a short time after that photo was taken, but if she lost her life at the hands of one or both of her parents while alone in those woods, then that's just too frightening and heartbreaking to contemplate. There haven't been any serious developments in the investigation since the family's remains were discovered 8 years ago, but if no one else was involved, then there really isn't much that can be done. However, if there is someone out there who has gotten away with the murders of 3 people, then they deserve to be brought to justice. So if you happen to have any information on the deaths of the Jamison family, please contact the Latimer County Sheriff's Office at 918-465-2161. That's 918-465-2161. Anyway, another special thanks to Jenny Kapoor for narrating the opening of this episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't done so yet, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see covered on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line Trail Went Cold Contest to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Since last month was October, we decided to release a Halloween-themed episode for patrons in Tiers 2 and 3 about the infamous Cash Landrum UFO incident, where 2 women and a child supposedly had an encounter with a UFO on a remote Texas road one night, and may have wound up being exposed to radiation, which gave them serious illnesses. I'm also going to be dropping the occasional exclusive bonus Patreon episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, and we recently released an episode in which myself and my co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discussed the unsolved murder of Todd McAfee. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I would also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Aaron W., Julie M., and Alyssa P. Thank you all so much for your support. I'm also pleased to announce that The Trail Went Cold has been added to the lineup for Podcast Row at CrimeCon 2022, which is being held in Las Vegas from April the 29th until May the 1st. If you would like to purchase tickets, we already have our own personalized promo code to get a discount. So to receive a 10% discount off a standard badge, please visit crimecon.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. Once again, that's crimecon.com and the promo code is TRAIL. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, which has a number of interesting discussions about today's case. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Anyway, like I mentioned in the intro, I will be taking next week off to move to a new place, so instead of the release of a new episode next Wednesday, we will be dropping one of our older Patreon bonus episodes into our feed. But we will return as scheduled the following Wednesday, December the 1st, so have yourself a good 2 weeks, and join us again when we kick off December with another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶